Hello and welcome to The Climate Clinic, a podcast brought to you by the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. My name is Adesh Sundaresan, and I'm a doctor from University College London. In this series, Be the Expert, I'll be joined weekly by my co-host, Dr. Mark Futenik, an emergency physician from Los Angeles. Each week, Mark and I will bring you the latest headlines from climate and health research from the leading evidence-based journals from around the world. Tune in to learn about the health implications of climate change, how this is affecting us today, and what needs to be done. By the end of it, you'll know all you need to know in order to be the expert. Welcome back to episode 14 of Be the Expert. How have you been, Mark? What is the news from over the pond in Los Angeles?
Well, we've had some gorgeous weather here lately, which is really nice, but I'm excited that I've been able to book a couple of climate talks coming up, one at an emergency medicine residency and the other at a middle school. We'll all be talking to each of the PE classes all day long about heat and climate change and health.
Mark, you're in high demand. You're in high demand. You've got the podcast, you've got events with schools, adults. Fantastic. In this episode today, we're going to be covering an original study published in the Lancet Planetary Health in May 2022. And the title of this paper was Long-Term Exposure to Wildfires and Cancer Incidents in Canada, a Population-Based Observational Cohort Study. The authors for this paper were Jill Korsiak, Lauren Pienault, Tanya Christidis, Richard Burnett, Michael Abrahamovitz, and Scott Weikenthal. Mark, tell us a bit about the context for this study and why it was relevant.
Well, Adesh, we know that over the past few years, wildfires have ravaged vast areas around the globe. And I've talked about the witch's brew, and you can't see me, but I'm putting that in air quotes, witch's brew of toxins in the air when wildfires engulf our modern infrastructure, particularly all those plastics. Plastics are all made of hydrocarbons, and each of those subunits are carcinogenic even before we burn them and change them into even more toxic hydrocarbon compounds. The wildfires themselves have wide-ranging impacts on our health, mostly due to the harmful mix of pollutants that are released. And these affect air quality, and they also get into the soil and the local water. And many of these pollutants are carcinogenic, which then leads to the question, do wildfires increase our cancer risk? A secondary question is, can we prove it? This is an important question as these wildfires tend to reoccur in similar regions at the same time every year, with lengthening fire seasons and intensity owing to climate change. So the same communities are getting affected repeatedly, which, you know, we would worry increases the cancer risk. And in addition, many of these emitted pollutants are what we refer to as persistent chemicals, suggesting that the exposure to wildfire-derived pollutants continues well beyond the period when the fire is actually burning or that we see smoke in the air. Those who understand the physiology and toxicology innately understand how terrible wildfire smoke must be, and these researchers are seeking to prove those suspicions.
So Mark, you've set the context and we have the why this study was necessary now. So let's talk about the how. So the authors mentioned that this is the first study in the world to look at the associations between wildfires and several cancer outcomes, specifically lung cancer or brain tumors, and a few hematological malignancies, specifically non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and leukemia. Now, these outcomes, these cancers, were selected on the back of existing evidence related to known carcinogens and their associated cancer types, and known carcinogens that were emitted by wildfires in particular. Now, this was a large longitudinal study following over 2 million Canadians for over 20 years. Now, briefly, without going into too much detail, this cohort, or CanCheck, is a population-based cohort that followed around 3.5 million Canadians for mortality and cancer outcomes between 1996 and 2015. And they used annual residential postcodes to assign degrees of wildfire exposures for these individuals. So Mark, how exactly did they assess for wildfire exposure amongst the cohorts?
So first, I just want to repeat the power of this study, which used a subset of the patients in the cohort that Adesh described. They analyzed data on 2 million people over 20 years, amassing 34 million person years of observation in order to establish the statistical significance in the findings. So I'm going to get technical for a moment about how they define the wildfire exposure for each of these patients. They used a database called the National Burned Area Composite, NBAC, that generates maps of burned areas for all of Canada's forests on an annual basis, indicating where and when a fire has occurred and an estimate of the total area burned. So using this data, they calculated the total area of forest burned within a 20-kilometer and a 50-kilometer radius of each residential location for each year between 1986 and 2015. In order to gather data on the influence of the timing of exposure to wildfire, sort of harkening back to what we just talked about, how some of the pollutants persist, they also calculated 3-year, 5-year, and 10-year moving averages of the wildfire exposure. Impressively, the authors analyzed this data a few different ways to try their best to uncover the truth. So first, they analyzed the question based on whether each individual had ever been exposed to wildfire or not, period. They refer to this as the dichotomous exposure, which means sort of yes or no, in their analysis. Next, they examined 3 levels of exposure, either never exposed, and then a low exposure and a high exposure group, and they called this the categorical exposure analysis. And then finally, they analyzed the change in risk with increased area burned among exposed populations just as a continuous variable, so almost just like as a number that increases, you know, with any interval in between. They calculated the risk-related statistics using all of these methods, and the results are detailed in the articles. Another interesting feature of the study methodology is that they excluded people living in large cities, which they defined as more than 1.5 million people. And they did this to minimize confounding from the chronic poor air quality of our cities. So let's think about that. Considering the rapid rate of urbanization that we've discussed over the past 2 episodes, it's quite a statement that we can't use city dwellers as controls because their chronic carcinogen exposure would obscure the results. So Adesh, what were the findings from this study?
I just want to refer back to that point you just made, Mark. It's quite powerful, isn't it? The fact that the authors couldn't refer back to city dwellers as controls because their baseline carcinogen exposure might be so high that it was going to obscure the results. Within the cohort of about 2 million Canadians that they followed, there were around 43,000 cases of lung cancer, 3,700 brain cancer cases, about 12,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, close to 4,000 multiple myeloma, and almost 8,000 cases of leukemia. Well, you know, what does this mean as standalone values between these 2 million Canadians? Not a huge amount. But then, obviously, we need to have a look at how this ties in with wildfire exposure. So small risk increases were consistently seen for associations between wildfires and lung cancer, with the strongest association seen between any exposure to wildfires within a 50-kilometer radius of a residential location over the past 5 years. So positive associations were also seen between wildfires and brain tumor incidence, with the strongest association observed between any exposure to wildfires in a 50-kilometer radius of the residential location within the past decade.
So basically, the evidence from this study suggests that exposure to wildfires are indeed associated with an increased risk of lung cancer and brain tumors. The risks were similar between low exposure and high exposure group, and sometimes even larger in the low exposure group in the categorical analyses. However, no clear associations were observed for the continuous term. The bottom line is that statistically, the data did not demonstrate a clear dose response, which they aimed to achieve with these various analyses. And there were also inconsistent findings, such as higher rates despite farther distances from the source. So they discussed the potential reasons for these observations. The authors posited that several factors might have contributed to this result. They start by discussing the challenge of matching burn areas with actual exposure, despite having good data about each. Moreover, the concentrations of pollutants emitted from wildfires depend on a whole range of different factors, including the fuel type of the fire, meaning whether it's just natural vegetation versus man-made structures and all that's entailed when we burn man-made items, as well as fire characteristics such as the temperature of the fire. Other external factors such as wind patterns have an important role in determining where the pollutants travel and then deposit, and therefore a larger area burned might not necessarily translate into a higher risk despite the geographic proximity. But the increases in lung cancer and brain tumor rates are both statistically and practically significant. And what I mean is that sometimes with really large data sets, we can see differences that we know are statistically significant based on the data, but the clinical or real life difference may not be meaningful, such as a 1 or 2 point difference in blood pressure. But in this study, the increases in cancer were in the 5 to 10% relative risk range, so this is not a trivial risk. Leukemia and lymphoma also showed non-significant trends consistent with an increase, so the jury is still out on these cancers as well. And interestingly, the risk for multiple myeloma appeared to decrease. And there are a lot of reasons that these associations are difficult to prove, which will be evident when Adesh covers the mechanisms and the routes that are suspected to cause cancer in this setting.
Absolutely, Mark. 5 to 10% relative risk range is not trivial, as you've mentioned. Now, as you've said, in their discussion, the authors described some of the routes through which these wildfires can cause or result in cancer, as well as considering the strengths and limitations of their study. So besides the fact that there's increased smoke and air pollution directly elevating the risk of lung cancer from these wildfires, they also refer to a few other mechanisms that we might not have thought of off the bat. Now, I didn't realize this, but high concentrations of persistent free radicals that are generated from wildfires have actually been found in charcoal samples that remain stable for at least 5 years after the fire itself. So some of the carcinogenic pollutants can persist and contaminate soil and terrestrial environments, water, and indoor environments for long periods of time. Interestingly, Mark, many heavy metals that also get trapped in soils and vegetation actually become more bioavailable after these wildfires because of increases in soil erosion and ash dispersal as well. They then end up in our water bodies, they can accumulate in fish, get into the food chain, which could be an issue if humans eat these fish. In a similar way, wildfires are also an important source of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons to both land-dwelling and aquatic ecosystems. Violations of exposure limits for nitrates, disinfection byproducts, and arsenic in surface and groundwater have also been observed in areas that have been hit badly by wildfires. And Mark, you might be interested to hear this, but in wildfire-affected areas like California, concentrations of benzene and other volatile organic compounds that at least are partially occurring from the melting of plastic water pipes were found to be significantly higher compared to exposure limits.
I may be interested in hearing that, but I don't like hearing that. But this is exactly why these associations can be so hard to prove and why this is such an impressive study. These additional ground and water-related factors will dilute the observed effect because all the people in this study, controls, and those exposed to the wildfire are being exposed to similar cancer-causing pollutants over time. And this makes the timing of disease as well as the separation by proximity to the wildfire less powerful differentiators statistically. They also mention another issue, which is that these wildfire pollutants might collect indoors for longer periods of time, though there aren't many studies which have looked at this yet. In one study they cited, which was conducted during the wildfire season in Oregon in the U.S., indoor concentrations of gas phase polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which we've been talking about, which are cancer-causing, were higher than the outdoor concentrations, suggesting that once these pollutants enter the home, they might persist for even longer periods of time than outdoors. On the other hand, two studies found limited retention of heavy metals and these same aromatic hydrocarbons in house dust collected 1 to 2 years after a major wildfire event in Fort Mercury, Canada. So when we find discordance such as this in our research findings, that means it's time for more studies to find the truth. Just before we wrap up, Adesh, I want to highlight some of the strengths and weaknesses of this study. As we know, it was a really large population-based cohort monitored over a significant duration. However, it did have some limitations. So first of all, their conceptual pathway from environmental pollution exposure to cancer was the only route that was really considered in this study. And there are other mechanisms that are possible as well, such as psychological stress and maybe the fire impacted the healthcare system so that people couldn't get their screenings, et cetera. They also only looked at a small number of cancer types, the brain, lung, and the hematologic. But given what we talked about, heavy metal exposure and some of the air pollution toxins, the future studies could look at bladder cancer, breast cancer, and others that we know are associated with those same toxins. And then they also talked about that the exposure measurement method may not have been ideal, and that some of the estimates of area burn that was based on residential locations maybe wasn't the best measure based on their home address, and that future studies possibly could use something like air monitors situated at strategic locations so that we would know the actual exposure for people in that area and not just really basing it off of their distance from the wildfire. But I just want to say, despite these limitations, this was a really powerful and well-done study. These limitations and others we've talked about today highlight the challenge of studying human health in general, particularly as it relates to slow-moving and far-reaching changes, such as with climate change. But this is exactly the kind of research we need in order to prove what we know logically, in order to provide that stronger impetus, or really an alarm bell, for the change that we need now.
Absolutely, Mark. I think this was a great article for all our listeners. You can check out the link as usual in the show description. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we look forward to welcoming you back soon to Be the Expert.